Hello, everyone. Good morning. How are you this morning? Beautiful, beautiful. I had a beautiful reminder of home this morning. I was telling 9:30 when I woke up and my wife says, "It's so beautiful outside today." Now, I expected it to just be, 102 at 8 in the morning this morning because that's what happens in California. But instead, it was raining. Just a beautiful reminder of dreary, depressing, wet Seattle, which I so love. So it was quite a reminder of home, just absolutely beautiful. Well, if you're like me, maybe you have gone in the past few weeks to see the movie that everyone seems to be talking about, Black Panther. Maybe, oh, it seems like some of you have been there. I'm not gonna do by a show of hands, but I'm fairly certain that a lot of us have seen this movie. Why is it? It seems to be almost a cultural phenomenon at this moment in time. First Marvel film with an all-black cast, black writers, and black director. And recently was just actually promoted to the top 10 most highest grossing movies of all time in the domestic United States. So some awesome accomplishments that it's been making, but maybe it's okay. I know what you're thinking, so I'm gonna say it for you. I'm gonna verbalize it. The only black guy is up here just talking about Black Panther. It's okay, it's fine. I said it, you didn't say it, so you're safe. But maybe in your head, for those of you who haven't seen the film, you've wondered, why is it such a big deal? Why are people so excited about it? Well, my wife actually showed me a video this week that I think illustrates pretty well why it's such a big deal. So I wanted to show it to you. It's a really, really short clip. Cute film here of these two boys looking at the movie poster for Black Panther and saying, "I'm this one." No, I'm this one. This is why it's so important to us. This is why it's so exciting for people of color everywhere. Because when I was around their age, I remember going to recess, hanging out with the homies, and just kind of sitting around and pretending that we were different superheroes or action heroes, saying like, by the way, little side note, my favorite superhero is Aquaman. Just a little side note. But as you know, Aquaman is not black. And so for me growing up, I had all these favorite superheroes and characters. I loved to watch Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and other movies like that, but none of my favorite heroes ever looked like me. And so for children of color to look up to heroes and to say, I want to be a hero like that. I want to be intelligent like that. I want to be an achiever like that. It's just so beautiful. It's why we're so excited. But the film was so inspiring to these two little boys, and it sort of inspired me in the same way. So since seeing it, I was just so moved by the beauty and all of the outfits, all of the clothing, the music, just the culture, just everything, that I was like, wow, I need to dig into my story, my culture a little bit more. If you haven't known, because maybe we haven't quite met yet, I'm still trying to get to everyone. I apologize if I haven't shook your hand and said hello and looked you into your soul. It hasn't happened yet, but it will at some point. I am Jamaican by blood, was not born there. Was not born there, but I am by blood. And so I decided I want to delve into a little bit of my own story. So I went to the place that we all go when we want things, Amazon.com, and I promptly purchased two history books of the Jamaican people. And I've just been trying to like pour over and listen and dig myself into the story of my people, and it's been really, really interesting. What I've found is something not as beautiful as the movie Black Panther. What I found was actually at times a story that was disturbing, that was frustrating, that was saddening, a story of pain, a story of betrayal, but a story that has been so moving to me and empowering in my own identity. I'm talking about the story of Kudjo, the escaped slave and freedom fighter hailed as a hero of the Jamaican people. As the oral history goes, Kudjo was born to an Ashanti chief in Ghana, but was captured by slave traders and brought over to the island of Jamaica. After escaping, he became sort of notorious for leading a band of escaped slaves, and they would sort of raid plantations, they would free slaves, they would steal supplies, and they became really kind of a thorn in the side of the British during this time period. His tactics and other leaders like him were so effective that the British actually ended up naming a whole war after what they were doing. It was called the First Maroon War of Jamaica. Maroons referring to this group of escaped slaves or slaves that kind of washed up on a shipwreck that gathered together and formed these cities in the jungles and mountains of Africa. They would engage in guerrilla warfare, and their fighting style was so actually effective that the British had to form a treaty with them in 1739. And so in 1739, they put forth this treaty, and the terms were as follows. There would be a ceasefire between the British and the Maroons, but in return, the Maroons would return any escaped slaves back to their masters. They would also have to return any slaves that had been with them for up to 2 years. Sort of a great reversal of everything they had once stood for. Now, as I read this history, I try and get into the minds of the characters and try and place myself in the time period. And I'm thinking, in trying to get into the mind of Kudjo, like, what must it have been like to be living a life of inconsistencies, where you are now fighting and opposing the very thing that you stood for so long? As the story goes, Kudjo was old and tired of the fighting and hoped that maybe a treaty would ease the pain on his people, and so signed the documents, essentially giving up the fight that he had been fighting for so long. It seems to be a tension, doesn't it, that we all feel, that we too are people of inconsistencies, that we too find ourselves in the place where we said we would never be that person, we would never do that thing, I'll never be like my mother, I'll never be like my grandfather, I'll never be that way, I'll never do this thing, but then the very thing we promised ourselves we would never do or never become, sometimes we end up being. We end up living a life of inconsistency and betrayal. And at that point, I wonder if we can relate a little bit with Judas the traitor. Jesus, as we read your words, I pray that you would speak, that you would just make me really tiny and small, and my voice really insignificant, and that your voice would be significant, and that it would move us to action. In Jesus' name.
Amen.
We find ourselves on the Thursday before Jesus will be crucified. It is Passover week, and so Jesus gathers his closest followers, the 12, around himself for one final Passover meal. We see it illustrated here in these beautiful, aren't these beautiful? These beautiful panels behind me here. An epic story. We all sort of know how it goes, but let's read it again. I want to get into the story one more time. After saying these things, Jesus was troubled in his spirit and testified, "Truly, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." The disciples looked at one another, uncertain of whom he spoke. One of his disciples, whom Jesus loved, was reclining at the table at Jesus' side. So Simon Peter motioned to him to ask Jesus of whom he was speaking. So that disciple, leaning back against Jesus, said to him, "Lord, who is it?" And Jesus answered, "It is he to whom I will give this morsel of bread when I have dipped it." So when he had dipped the morsel, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. Then after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered into him. Jesus said to him, "What are you going to do? What you are going to do, do quickly." Now no one at the table knew why he said this to him. Some thought that because Judas had the money bag, Jesus was telling him, "Buy what you need for the feast," or that he should give something to the poor. So after receiving the morsel of bread, he immediately went out, and it was night. I've discovered there are essentially two types of people in the world. People who enjoy movie spoilers and enjoy knowing the plot ahead of time, and people who are going to heaven. That's what I have discovered. My wife and I are essentially two ends of the spectrum in that category. To my horror, early in my marriage, I discovered this very early when we were watching a movie of some kind together, and I looked over, and hidden behind a little pillow, my wife, Abby, was Wikipediaing the plot of the movie we were watching while we were watching it so she could know what would happen ahead of time. I turned and I said, "What are you doing? This is the whole point of the movie. This is the whole point of the story. You want to just enjoy it as it happens. Like, that's the whole point of a story, right? Like, don't you want to be surprised?" Her response, she turned to me and said, "No." I was like, what? I don't even understand. I don't understand people like you. So I'm working on honoring my wedding vows to just love her well. And I know the problem is with me, it's not with her. But it's just so hard because I'm just such a lover of stories. Such a lover of stories. And I feel like, man, spoilers, they just ruin it. But if you are like my wife and you enjoy spoilers, then the story of Judas is for you. Because we already know the story of Judas ahead of time. We already know what's going to happen from the very beginning. In Mark chapter 3, from the get-go, when the author introduces us to Judas, he says, "And Judas, the one who would betray him." So we already know the spoilers. We basically, you know, we know what's going to happen after the after credit scene. We know that Judas betrays Jesus in the end. So my question is not what happens in the story, but rather how. How could you do this, Judas? How could you do this? From the beginning, Judas, you watch this from the beginning. You watch this movement start from scratch. How could you betray Jesus? Judas, you were on that boat in Galilee, right? You were on that boat when the storm hit and everyone thought they were gonna die. And then you went to Jesus and said, "Don't you care that we're gonna die?" And Jesus stood up and said to the storm, "Be quiet." And the storm was quiet. And he witnessed that with his own eyes. Judas, how could you? Judas, you were there when Lazarus died. You probably watched Jesus as he wept. And like any good friend, I imagined in my historical fiction sort of mind that maybe he wept with him. And you were there, Judas, when Jesus stood in front of the tomb, a day too late to save Lazarus. And when he said, "Lazarus, come out of the tomb." And you saw with your own eyes that when Jesus speaks, even death has to listen. How could you betray Jesus? What are you doing? How could you betray Jesus? This topic brings to mind a couple conversations I had with some friends over the past few weeks. The first was with a friend who confessed to me that he had been caught by his wife looking at some inappropriate content on his phone one night. He said the look in her face when she found him, the look of betrayal and disgust and pain, was one of the hardest things he had seen. My other friend, a young woman I was having conversation with, and she was explaining to me what it felt like to lose her virginity when she didn't expect to. She said she felt utterly worthless. She recalled how she had made all these promises to herself, how she had created this list of things she would never do, but then found herself in the place where she had done all of them. Why do we do this? Why are we people of inconsistencies? And how does Judas get to the point where he's standing in front of the tomb, witnessing resurrection, and then betraying Jesus? I would argue the reason we find ourselves betraying the things we love and the reason Judas can betray Jesus is because betrayal is the human condition. Right? We all have this sense that there's a way of God, this way of Jesus that we all know and we all love. And if you're a Christian, we proclaim to follow the way of Jesus. We say that this is the way that I live my life. But then at times we often find ourselves on the opposite of that. We often find ourselves enemies of the way of Jesus. Isn't this what Paul was trying to get at in Romans chapter 7, where he said, "I find it to be a principle of life. I find this principle in my life, in my heart, that when I want to do what is right, I inevitably just end up doing what is wrong." This principle that there's some sort of inconsistency that lives in my heart. I feel like the author Frederick Buechner calls this struggle, I think he names it really well when he calls it confusion of face. He talks about how we each have like a war going on between us, between the face that we show people and the inner face. inside, this war going on between who I say I am and who I project to be and my secret desires, the things I actually want. He says this is also flip-flopped at times. Sometimes we project some sort of mean or evil face when in reality there's another face inside that really wants the way of God. Confusion of face. He describes it this way. He says, there is the conscience, for instance, the inner voice, which says the face I wear is not the face I ought to wear, that it is somehow wrong to be indifferent, pitiless, and afraid. But beneath the conscience, the sense of guilt, there's a much deeper level, not just that I ought not to be what at my worst I appear, but that I do not really want to be. This is challenging, this rule of inconsistencies of the human heart. And I hope this doesn't come off as like preachy or condemnatory or judgmental, because I feel this in my own life. I feel this in my own life, right? We each proclaim to follow the way of Jesus, but we find ourselves at times being the enemy of that way. I experienced this the other day when I was at Target one evening. Target, the place where all good and bad things happen, is what I have learned. Target. I was going to Target to get something for my wife, and on my way out, as I headed to my car, a man stopped me. Really, really kind, kind of polite, and he says, "Excuse me, sir, just want a second of your time. I'm wondering, I just got out of prison today, and I have a place to go, but I have no way to get there. So I'm wondering if you could spare just like $5 for like a bus or taxi, an Uber, like just a few bucks." In that moment, I felt so many things swirling around inside, right? I'm a pastor. This is like, I have to, it's like I get paid to do these types of things. Like I have to do this. And like, I'm a Christian. I say I follow the way of Jesus. Jesus says that I'm supposed to do this. Jesus says if someone asks me for their shirt, that I should give them my coat as well. Jesus says I should go the extra mile, right? So I have to do this. And all these things swirling in my mind, like maybe I should go back into the store and like, you know, get a little candy bar and like get $5, $10 of cash back or whatever and give it to this guy. But in the moment, I just felt tired and exhausted and overwhelmed, and I wanted to get home to my wife. And I just scrambled underneath the cushions of my car for a couple dirty pennies and a quarter. And I handed it to him. I was like, "Hey man, this is all I got." The look on his face told me that he knew what was going on, that he had had this interaction before. He says, "Thanks." And I said, you know, trying to backtrack, like, "Oh, hey man, can I like buy you a meal or something? Like, is there anything I can do?" He says, "It's all right, don't worry about it." And he walked away. This interaction comes to mind because it actually brings to mind one of my greatest fears in life. One of my greatest fears in life is when I stand before Jesus at the end. Now, you may be wondering, why is this one of my greatest fears? This is a grace-oriented church. What are we talking about? We believe in the gospel here. One of my greatest fears is because Jesus says that in that moment, the only conversation that he'll have with me, that he'll have with all of us, is, "When I was naked, did you feed me? When I was in prison, did you visit me? When I was thirsty, did you give me something to drink?" My greatest fear is I'll stand in front of Jesus and he'll say, "I don't know you. You never fed me. You never gave me something to drink." We are people of inconsistencies. So the question that burns in my mind, here's the question that I think we have to solve and get to, is how do we come to terms with the fact that while we all say we're followers of Jesus, we will at some point or another in our lives betray everything he stands for? How do we come to terms with this? Basically, in the words of Paul, who will save me from this body of death? Or in my words, how does God respond to my betrayals of him? How does God respond to betrayal? What is the divine response in the face of betrayal? To answer this question, I believe we have to go back to the Last Supper. I was telling 9:30, it feels so cool to stand up front and to like pause my talk and to take a little sip of water as if I'm some famous person. You know, you see like super intellectual, famous people. They'll just be up and they'll just, hold on one sec, let me drink. So I'm feeling really cool about it, even though I'm not quite there. Let's get back to the story. A couple of interesting things that I learned about this final meal that Jesus has with his disciples. The first thing is that we have this traditional scene, most made famous by Da Vinci, this painting of the Last Supper of Jesus at this sort of straight table. But what we find is that in Jesus's day and age, that they actually probably wouldn't have been sitting at a table like this. They would have been sitting at a sort of a U-shaped table. It was called a triclinium. It was this table that was super low to the ground. It'd be sort of surrounded by mats or couches, and you would sort of recline there. And I've always loved that word in that story when Jesus said him and his disciples reclined. Now, they would probably recline together in this U-shaped space, and the positions of where the disciples were sitting was also especially significant. We're going to focus on John and Judas today because I don't want to give any spoilers for Peter, which is coming in the next couple weeks. So we're not going to talk about Peter because you know I hate spoilers. We're going to talk about John and Judas. What I learned was that John, sitting to the right hand of Jesus, this was especially a significant space to be seated in. If the host seated you in the right hand position to himself, that meant he considered you a very intimate, close friend. Which makes sense, John the Beloved, John naming himself as the one whom Jesus loved, John leaning back at the meal against Jesus's chest, right? The only way he could have done that is if he was sitting next to Jesus. So we have John, the intimate friend, to his right. But what about Judas? Sitting to the left of Jesus. Was it perhaps custom that the host would place his greatest enemy to his left? What about Judas? I was shocked to discover that the guest to the left of the host was traditionally the guest of honor. Maybe some of us wonder, how? This is Judas. We already know. We already know he's the villain. We already know that Judas is the Darth Vader of this story. We know what happens in the end. We know where this goes. We know that Judas is going to betray Jesus. And we can imagine that Jesus even knows that what Judas is going to do because he says that he knows what Judas is going to do. So why does Jesus place Judas in the position of honor to his left? What's more, the very sign that Jesus uses to tell John that Judas is the betrayer, the dipping of the bread and handing it, was also considered a sign of great honor to the guest who received it. So why does Jesus do this? Why does Jesus honor his betrayer moments before he knows he will betray him? It seems to not make sense. It perplexes my mind. I was reading one of the early church fathers, Papias, and he has this, I didn't put it on the screen because it was a little graphic and inappropriate, but he basically has this like horrible, grotesque description of Judas that just really grotesque and disgusting, and he describes him as like bigger than two wagons and just really offensive and awful, and it's this interesting trend in the early church to sort of paint Judas as like this horrible, disgusting villain. But we don't see Jesus doing that here. How is it that Jesus uses the very sign to tell Judas that he knows that he's about to betray him is simultaneously the greatest honor that you could have as a guest? I would argue that this, friends, is the gospel. This is the reminder that Jesus honors traitors at his table. This is an acting out of the kingdom of God that Jesus had been talking about the entire time. That the kingdom of God is a different way, that it's an upside down kingdom, that it's a kingdom where the enemies are supposed to be loved, where you serve the ones who betray you. This upside down kingdom. It's this acting out of Jesus loving his enemy even when he knows it will cost him his life. It's the revolutionary and scandalous claim that Christianity is not a list of steps I need to take or rules I need to keep in order to get to heaven, but that heaven comes to me. And when heaven comes to me, it knows my traitorous tendencies. It sits me in the seat of honor anyway. Tim Keller in his book, The Reason for God, I don't have it on the screen, but he has an interesting quote. He says that Christianity is not really a religion. Religion says I must do X, Y, and Z to get to the divine. Christianity is actually an anti-religion in that Christianity says the divine comes to me. The revolutionary and scandalous gospel of Jesus, that Jesus honors the traitors at his table. And praise be to God that he does, because I'm Judas too.